Hey, welcome back to the Rhetoric Warriors podcast. This is Rhetorician Wednesdays, all rhetoric, all day. Typically with Dr. David Payne. When Dr. David Payne's not available, I'll grab another rhetorician, but there's plenty in Payne's mind to learn a lot about rhetoric and what rhetoric is going to tell us about dealing with the modern world. We're helping people to win the rhetoric wars, the good people, right?
Absolutely.
That's right. That's our job. I'm Dr. Dan, American rhetorician, escaped professor, late night comedy writer, founder of Rhetoric Warriors. Head over to Rhetoric Warriors if you want to take a class. I'm about to release a new class. I think I'm going to call it Invincible Persuasion. It's the 21 Colosseums of Persuasion.
21 Colosseums. Okay.
That's what I realized is like every time you move somebody to a new Colosseum, like they... You know, there's all new tigers, new gladiators in there, and they don't know what to do. So like if you pull people out of logic over into emotion, suddenly all their skills fall apart.
You're in a new Colosseum.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
There you go.
So that's the gladiatorial combat, right?
Yeah. It's one of the visions of rhetoric, right? Combative, you know, war-based and.
Absolutely. Not to go down too far down that out, but Aristotle replaced a different vision with a kind of a militant. I guess he's been critiqued for, right? How do you marshal your armies to win the argument, right? This
is... Yeah, you know, I think all that stuff makes for strong metaphors. I've kind of laid out in the book that goes with that course, you know, all the different ways that you can look at rhetoric, because every time you jump over to one of those, again, you're kind of in a new Colosseum. You know, is it there to, like we talk about American democracy and the history of it, like, is it there to, you know, bring us together, you know, or is it to help one camp, you know, destroy the other? And both of those are there in American culture.
Right. Well, how you view rhetoric tends to depend upon how you're located, you know, in the bigger world, that if you, like the Christians, perceive yourself to already have the truth, and how do you win people to, right? How do you enforce that, right? If you're on the other end of some putative spectrum there, right, you're trying to equalize and have democratic searching for truth, right? I guess that's kind of a Platonic ideal. Then your view of rhetoric looks quite different. So yeah, I know we're rhetoric warriors here, but in thinking about some of the stuff, I thought I'm really a pacifist.
Yeah, that's true. Rhetorical pacifist. A sideliner.
Especially in thinking about the culture war, right? I think.
Well, and I always have been too. Like, I've never really taken strong stances out in the world and done rhetoric for a living, other than helping people in marketing, which, you know, is fairly amoral. Other than, you know, I'm clearly, you know, it's capitalist and trying to help somebody sell something. Beyond that, it's like, you know, you can look at its effects, but I've never really gotten into politics until politics got in my face.
Well, we were talking about that. I don't think we have any choice at this point in time. You really can't be very far away from it.
Well, and all the rhetoricians sitting on the sidelines really makes no sense. We're the ones that, you know, supposedly really study this and have something to say about it. And maybe we end up in this sort of dispassionate educator or academic space where we're just commenting, and then you can use whatever, you know, for your own purposes. But at some point, it does feel like you should marshal this stuff towards the side of the good.
I think so. I mean, I think, once again, I guess it depends on what your point of view is. If you're an advertiser, if you're an ideologue, if you're a propagandist, whatever, your view of this is going to look different. But I do think there is a kind of an ethic of how do you make this contribute in an ethical way to people's well-being? I do think, right? And certain views of rhetoric may be located in sort of standard American democratic values. I think that's kind of how it got resurrected in the 20th century as a way of looking at things. But so it mutates with the the social system itself.
Yeah. And I think too, like we were talking about this a little bit after the podcast last time, that if you look at sort of, if you allow the, you know, the story of Russia has weaponized and postmodernized propaganda brought it up to the level of super production and super distribution. And there's a guy online, I'll get his name and put it in the show notes, but he studies the Ukraine. He's from the Ukraine and he studies what Russia has done in the Ukraine. And he's like, yeah, everything they test in the Ukraine, they then go do a few years later to the US. He goes, and I can show you all the techniques. They've already been labeled and studied in the Ukraine because
right,
life and death over there. They're trying to be, you know, trying to get taken over actively with military and with rhetoric. Because, but they're just practicing it here and then releasing it on the West. And so under that circumstances, you know, it's sort of like you think of Einstein escaping Nazi Germany, right? And then helping build the bomb to, you know, drop on the Axis powers. It's like, well, maybe rhetoricians can drop a few bombs back on Russia.
Well, at least we ought to get to the first part of that, of realizing that this is a pretty systematic, known and observable set of techniques that are going on, and get out of denial about that, right?
Yeah. I mean, they're so good at inhabiting the flock, you know, the wolves in sheep's clothing, but they're so good at wearing the sheep's clothing that the sheep are not bothered by the fact that this seems like Americanism, right? It seems like Trump is an American talking American stuff because he's using this very strong traditional American rhetoric, but he's weaponized it in a completely different, for a completely different purpose. So alerting the sheep is not easy.
Right. Well, and there, you know, there not only are there rewards to looking the other way, but we all want to feel more or less comfortable. We enjoy the idea that we live in an open society, and that, you know, and we also walk around with the what may be the illusion that we are making our own choices and in control of these things, right?
Ah, the illusions.
But then on the other side of the coin, you have the people who do see themselves as engaged in a constant battle, and on both left and right. And so,
well, that kind of bridges us right to today's topic, which is cancel culture,
right?
Which is in the news right now, and we're going to try to cover some at least major themes so we can kind of title each Rhetorician Wednesday. So the theme this week is cancel culture. And you're starting to see it sort of explode in politics, like there are political uses of this idea of cancel culture. There's entertainment uses. Bill Maher keeps covering this because he's getting a lot of traction with it and did a rant on that show about it recently. And you're starting to see it, you know, used in a lot of different ways, but it's something that in some ways is brand new and digital, like it's digital vigilantism or it's digital justice. You know, that to me is like where I start with it. When you look at this, okay. So some of the things that are new about this is that you can actually get to powerful villains, which you've pretty much never been able to do. I mean, Bill Cosby had been talked about as a predator for 30 years before, God, what's the comic who outed him on stage? You know, a black male comic actually outed him on stage. And then people started.
I didn't know this story, but go ahead.
So, like, there's ways to get to the potential, the powerful. Mm-hmm. And that's never been available before. So that's new. And you can now actually have effects on those people. They can't just dodge, evade, and squash you. If you look at Louis C.K., and his history with this stuff, he had evaded these, you know, accusations of public exposure and all this stuff to women for a long time by squashing it. So you can now have power on them, but that opens up the fact that there's no due process for any of this.
Right. Right.
So suddenly we're, you know, upset about Pepe Le Pew.
Well, you know what you're saying. Reminds me of something that resonates for me often enough, which is the old idea that where all media is headed is to create a global village. A lot of these are village politics, right? You can't run and hide from it. So the conditions that you describe, you know, rumors can land and people will know each other's business. And along with the kind of the tribalism in which this gets manifest as far as the culture war goes. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's this weird space. And I have done some of this work for the marketing agency 500 Rockets that I have here in Austin with a partner. And it started with this idea that you get these spheres. You have the private sphere over here, and you know, the public sphere, and those have all kind of interacted, you know, in the public for a long time. But now the digital bridges those and merges them. Suddenly, people who are basically living their private lives can instantly be pulled over into the public at any moment.
Right, right.
And with business people, that's dangerous, because we got hired by a guy who was a big time real estate developer and had had a little brush up with another developer, and the guy charged him with something. And so they mugshotted him, and Fox goes down and into mugshots and publishes them on all its websites. So suddenly that is the very first thing that's going to be pulled up about you in public is your mugshot, because it's backlinked to all the Fox media locations. And so this guy, you know, like, that's a huge hit for a business person. Their credibility just tanks. So it's a real danger, that merger between the public and private, and people aren't ready for it. Like, people in private life do not understand defending themselves in public. You know, they're not prepared. They have no defense team. They're not, you know.
Well, and the way this is practiced often enough, there isn't any defense. Once stained, you're, you know, furthermore, no one can come to your defense. So,
well, there is, but I mean, that's the thing about the digital structures and aesthetics and practices, rhetorical practices even, haven't really been established. You know, like, there are ways to defend yourself. I'm helping with a friend with this right now. She got sideswiped a little bit about something, and they immediately go to deliberative and forensic rhetoric, right? Trying to explain themselves and, you know, prove this and be logical. And I'm like, that's not the game. You know, look at even the history of apologia. Just throw yourself on the mercy of the court and get out of the court. You know, that's a much stronger strategy than staying in there and trying to argue with 1,000 people.
Well, sure. But I mean, if you've got a lot to lose, you know, back to Cuomo, a year ago, he was maybe going to be the leading contender to be president.
Right.
Now we've talked about it long enough that they're saying, and once again, this is the frame of the conversation, you know, talk about a lack of due process. The investigation's going, yada, 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 but we are still chatting it every day and speculating, well, about the impact, which is, then becomes a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. So this morning's commentary as well, there's probably no way he can get reelected, right? Whether or not he resigns. So, you know.
Well, take it as a rhetorical project. What would you do for that guy? Like, to me, that what they're doing right now, like these old PR strategies, they call it crisis management and PR, and sure, they're failing horribly in the digital space. Like, you can't just ignore this. You can't release, you know, kind of an innocuous denial. You know, you need better tactics and better strategies, and they don't have them. Like, they have not really thought through what a good, like, if you look at Trump on the other side, they have very strong digitally based strategies. Trump just attacks the attackers, you know, all out. Like, it's not even close. Like, if you say anything lightly bad about him, he will attack you with all barrels, which is an effective strategy.
Well, effective in the arena, I guess. I mean, he is a guy that got impeached twice and may, you know, he thinks he may be able to run again with his approval rating and his and the whatever percentage of people that he has. I don't know. We don't know. I think that's kind of the mystery, right? We don't know how that will play.
Right.
In terms of maintaining a brand or if he had a job with a regular corporation, if he, you know, he might not be succeeding with it, I guess is what I'm saying. He's managed to keep his and improve on his loyal following, I guess.
75 million of them.
People, but those are people who kind of like the fight that he's in. It seems to me that's a limiting set of options. He's not really going to be able to transcend that stuff.
No, he's not. But he doesn't try. He
We don't know whether he could make money any other way or not. There seems to be very little evidence that he can.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, he was, you know, they were talking about when he first got into politics, it was trying to polish up his brand, which had, you know, died down badly. So he was trying to get more exposure.
Yeah, he was selling steaks and bad wine before he, you know, went down this road and ties. So
you then tell me, like, some of what would you do? Just sort of, I know you haven't thought this out as far as specific tactics and strategies, but what would you do to defend somebody?
Well, that's a great question, and once again, I think we're in a whole new coliseum here. As concerns that, and I think you're talking about this sort of the PR lore surrounding this, and some of my rhetorical friends were part of that. You know, how do you do issues management? And the idea there is that an issue is going to live a certain kind of life in the media, and how do you get out in front of it? How do you anticipate? And what is sort of the dynamic? Well, I think maybe your insight is that that's all been short-circuited. That, you know, these are more like collectivizing, you know, with Twitter and a number of activists monitoring with a number of purposes coming together, sort of the instantaneousness of it. These stories aren't living up. So I guess on both ends, you know, there's kind of the Ted Cruz, this will go away in 24 hours, right?
Oh man, that's good comedy right there.
Yeah, really? I'm just going to show some footage of me handing out water at the food bank, and this is, you know, because in a way his image was already
he's so already divided. In tatters.
And who knows? And then there's the other side of the coin, which is that Ted Cruz that, you know, sort of abandoned Texas for some people is never going to go away. So. I think it's maybe he and Trump are both cases of people who are just willing to stay in the gladiators, willing to stay in there and get
right.
Hacked.
Yeah, stick as many swords in me as you want. I'm not going down.
Exactly, and that seems to be kind of the Cuomo thing, where okay, I apologized, and okay, I've shown that I could turn it over a new leaf. I'm newly sensitized here. None of that being sufficient.
No.
So this morning he comes up, well, I'm not going anywhere. You'll have to, you know, impeach me.
Well, so, go back and look at like Anthony Weiner and see how well that works.
Right, right. So, you know, and so it does seem to be sort of a process of erosion, and it does evolve into this, you know, where it's a battle where people are there to take you down and they either will or they won't succeed. But we'd have to think about what are the cases of people who successfully sort of restored their image. So the whole thing about apology or apologia, that was kind of the lore about how do you deal with these situations, may not really be, you know, if there are active interests in getting at you, about all you can just go away.
Yeah, I think on the left especially, like, because the left runs on the ethos of morality, moral character, and the right doesn't. I mean, it can flick around, you know, from its version of moral character is literally just, hey, I'm still a Christian, I'm still, you know, austere, I'm still this. All this doesn't matter. Like, as long as I've got those core elements, that other stuff, you know, it'll bounce off of me at some point. But the left can be brought down so easily because they run on such angelic, you know, democratic, and like, we are representing the best of the people and all that. One little flaw and man, they can get pulled unraveled so quickly.
There does seem to be quite a double standard, right? Notwithstanding the right wing at these moments, when it comes to personal character and these personal picadillos, right, they seem to kind of just hush and let it happen. I like Trump's response to when Biden was accused, and he says, well, maybe he's not guilty. I've certainly have been accused many times wrongly, you know, and then just kind of shut up and let it. So, the strategist sort of let the left take itself down this. And I think that gets back to the whole cancel culture thing. There is that seems to be a left issue for liberals in general. The right wing seems to be just sort of relishing the outrage. This just becomes another little flashpoint for them to delight in what's happening over there.
Yeah, it's just more coal in the outrage furnace. You know, like, oh, Dr.
Exactly. Seuss,
whoosh. You know, oh, Mr. Potato Head, whoosh. It's just, you know, it doesn't matter as long as that it's got some kind of cultural value that you can throw into the outrage furnace.
Right. Because, yeah, as far as I'm concerned, they have practiced something like, you know, cancel culture for a long time. I mean, from trying to ban the Wizard of Oz because it's a magic-centered world, or, you know, John Lennon's music, or, you know, heavy metal. I mean, that whole thing, that's been going on for 40, 50 years.
Right, rap, video games.
And all the way into, you know, Donald Trump wanting to fire all the NBA players who took a knee. That impulse is not alien to them at all. Right, even in both the secular and the religious moralities that are being exercised there. So it's pretty hypocritical for them to jump on the Mr. Potato Head bandwagon.
That's funny. We're saying that as a real adult, you know, issue. Pepe Le Pew.
Exactly. If Mr. Potato Head really had been physically gendered, he would have been banned long ago by the right. Right.
Oh my God, a potato wedge. Get that out of my face. Yeah, it's, you know, and these things tie so easily back into such large marginalizing, you know, issues. Like the Aunt Jemima syrup, you know, that ties into such a big reservoir of anger and woundedness and bad history. And it's a tiny little pop culture thing, but it's like an iceberg with all this darkness underneath it. And all these issues are that way. All the cancel culture issues are that way. Even the Cuomo thing, you know, that these girls were young. You know, the picture of him holding the young girl's face, and he's this old white dude standing up over top of her. It piles into this whole iceberg of, you know, all the massive centuries of male domination and, you know, horrible behavior. The same way, like, you know, the Me Too culture could pull all of that rage and pain up into these people. And when you get that focused on one person, you know, that scapegoating factor, the ability to just take all that rage and drive it into that one human is intense.
Right. And I think you're talking about that point where criticism and becomes a quest for justice, right? That it is not enough to get a new improved Mario Cuomo out of the deal or to raise awareness about the behavior. That he must pay somehow. This person no longer. So it is that search for punishment rather than just part of the critical process. And there is a kind of an unburdening in that, I suppose.
Sure.
I think you're dead on target. That people have pain out there that they can connect to this.
One of the things I don't see in the people being canceled is the sense of atonement or reparations or, you know, the kind of self-scarification and flagellation that might get you out of some of this. You know, they don't seem to be using that resource very much. And I said this about Louis C.K. when he had his troubles about things. I'm like, yeah, he comes out and apologizes. You see a lot of these people will apologize and they attempt to do a decent apology. It's usually a badly written apology because it's beyond their skill set, which again, be nice if you had a rhetorician helping you with this, but they offer nothing to the victims. There's no atonement. Like if he just said, look, I, you know, these people were young. I, you know, harmed their careers. I'm going to give each of you $1 million to kind of make up for that. And I know it's not, you know, but it is a type of reparations and it will help your career. And I will do anything I can do to help you because I was wrong. But all they do is say I was wrong with no sense of atonement or reparations or loss. You know, they lose a lot financially and they lose the reputation, all that, but we don't get any satisfaction out of that. And the victim doesn't get anything.
So you're thinking there needs to be some kind of alternative justice system. That goes back to the Greek conditions under this professorial moment, right? When rhetoric became popular and invented in ancient Greece, it was because of the practice of if you sued somebody in the court and won, you would exchange property. This was the idea. And so the rules for rhetoric became actually advice on how to win in that court. That's where the first ideas about systematizing rhetoric came from. And so now you're back to that as a kind of an informal, right? We're not talking about the legal system here, right? Because that is the deflection. Okay, we're going to have an investigation. The attorney general is going to, let's just wait for, and in this case, at least from what I've heard, it doesn't sound like laws were broken. It doesn't sound like technically the legal definitions of harassment were, you know, obtained there, which is systematic and, you know, whatever. But that's not going to satisfy the sense of, so you're looking for alternative ways of satisfying that.
Yeah. And I think kind of, you know, you also don't see hyper honesty where, and this is one of the differences in Louis C.K. in the way he approached it. He did a bit of hyper honesty, a bit of it, you know, they don't come out and say, yes, I see that I did these things. It's never, I knew I was doing this in the moment and I realize it's wrong, but I'm a dude, I'm 50 years old. This is kind of in my culture. I let the power get to me. It was a wrong thing to do, and I am sorry. And here's what I'm going to do because of it. Like, to me, they're not using the full set of rhetorical tools that could maybe get them out of this.
You might absolutely be right. You might be the guy to hire. There has to be some sort of, I think you're right in your analysis that that's what's wrong with just simply issuing an apology, without a certain amount of sincerity or even sort of accepting of loss, because, you know, people will push it until there is some. That is that sense of justice that, you know, has to take place there. Now, as I understand it, Louis C.K. still performs and still has audiences.
It took him like a year. He went to France, escaped some of this because the heat is different around the country, around the world about this stuff. But I mean, that cost him hundreds of millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. That was literally his financial and the hit of.
And his TV career is.
Yeah. He went from, you know, one of the favored sons of America to one of the most disdained people.
Right. Well, that's also a pretty, that's a pretty hard one to come back from. I mean, that's a pretty specialized.
Sexual stuff especially is hard. But I mean, again, My thing about rhetoric, the way I've ended up dicing it up in my life, isn't to go out and protect the unethical or the immoral or, you know, people who deserve punishment. It's not to help them evade that, but it is the sense that there should be a due process. It should be somewhat just in the punishment. Like, is it just for him to lose hundreds of millions of dollars for maybe 5 or 10 of these interactions? What was the effect on the victims? Is there something better he could do? Like, if he had taken $50 million and made a victims fund and said, look, take $5 million each, you know,
it would have been a better financial deal for him.
Yeah. And, you know, was his crime, part of his problem was he got right in the very moment of Me Too with Weinstein, Cosby, you know, all these big sort of Les Moonves, big famous people who got pulled down all at the same time. He got pulled into that too. And I'm not like what you said, you know, I should be the guy to get hired to defend these guys. I don't want to be associated with them either, because you end up in that whirlpool.
I mean, hired to consult them on how to restore their image, not necessarily the public.
And not to evade it, but to make it right. And that's the thing, like making it right is what they're not doing.
I think cancel culture in general, it's a
horrible thing to get canceled, because you feel like you're being over punished by people you don't even know in this invisible mob, which are all the elements of it that haven't been worked out, right? The justice element of it. But you have to accept you're in a public digital space, and that universe, you better have some different, you know, skills and tactics, because it's going to happen.
Sure. Well, what I guess I sort of see my place here is what does sort of theorizing and knowing about rhetoric tell us about that? And what I also hear you saying is there needs to be process here, that this is kind of new, and because it's a different coliseum, this is a different sort of arena,
new tigers.
And so, they got a new improve. Or it's like in those other Spartacus movies where they bring out the biggest, baddest guy, right, ever, right? And all of a sudden you've got to fight him.
Well, really, so, what this is they suddenly release, 50,000 kids or 50,000 little hamsters coming after you. Like, a lot of these people that are making, these things stick are coming out of the woodwork. They're not like lateral power people. Sure. They're tiny people. And they've found a way to into the digital coliseum, and they know how to take a bite. And sometimes that bite, it gets infected, and it's like a little Komodo dragon. You're coming down. Like, Cuomo is coming down. He can stand there and water buffalo his way for a couple of weeks, but he's coming down.
Right. Well, do you think that there is the possibility for him to kind of come out and say, I think something has to happen first, right? But there has to be kind of a moment. But before he could kind of come out and say, all right, I'm going to, work for, help establish, find some sort of actual repair, either for these individuals personally that he's offended, or like you're talking about with Lee C.K., starting some sort of clinic or whatever. I don't know. But, I think in a way, we are back to this kind of village politics here, village shaming, where you're going to have to wear the scarlet letter.
And, right. That's exactly one of the things I was thinking.
You're going to be shunned. We don't know how restoration, there is no other place to go to sort of start over.
But people come back. You remember in Game of Thrones? Were you a Game of Thrones fan?
Sort of. I overheard a lot of it.
I can't remember a guy's name, Jordy or something, but he was Khaleesi's white guy who was dedicated to her, and he betrayed her. He was originally hired by the other side to kill her, but then fell in love with her and ended up protecting her. But then she found out and she banned him, and he worked his way back, through this trial by combat, and doing so many things for and so much effort to get back to, her good graces. But he earned it. These guys aren't earning it. Like, so Cuomo, maybe if we're like, okay, hey, we want you to help you stay in power. We think you're a good governor, but you have to earn that. You're gonna have to earn your way through this. And you start giving him ways of doing that, like starting a fund, or, like this idea of going to getting some, training, some diversity training and things like that is ridiculous. That's useless. That's not real reparations or real change. You need to be able to earn it and through some real horrible experience.
Well, I think once again, as long as you're, I think looking at the Cuomo case, just because it's on every day now, but all day seemingly, he's part of this is because he was so popular, and he's being taken down, and I think that's what divides differently about it, and so it's not just sort of here's a public figure that we found out. The timing of it is at issue here, so I think as long as you're in the arena, the way we're playing the game now is that you're reputationally. So when you were talking about finding a way, Bill Clinton, in a way, starting the after his presidency and starting the Clinton Foundation and all of that, he sort of lived with the stain and went on to restore himself as an elder statesman and somebody was doing good work. But then his wife, his wife gets pinned with all of his guilt or controversy. The debate where Donald Trump paraded all the women that it,
Yeah.
So you know, as long as you make any pre, and then very often, you know, if people want to get into it about Bill Clinton, that comes up. It isn't, as long as he's trying to be in the public arena, it follows him around.
Yeah, and that's part of it too. So if we accept the fact, okay, you've got this stain, you know, it's right here on your shoulder. It's always going to be there. You're not getting rid of that. Either we amplify all your goods, is kind of what they did with Nixon, right? To rehabilitate Nixon.
Right.
You know, elder statesmen, China, you know, that kind of stuff. And so they just amplified, and they just tried to let the Watergate stuff shrink. And over time, because nobody cared about Nixon anymore, it did. Now, if you're Cuomo and you're trying to survive in the moment, and you don't have that kind of time, you know, what's the strategy then? Like, to me, authenticity is one of these super strategies these days that tends to cut through an awful lot. And politicians are just scared of it. And entertainers end up scared of it, but they end up being really good at it if they'll do it. And so if you get him up there and be authentic, do some disclosure, do some authentic stuff instead of some political kind of talk, he might be able to get out of it. That's one of Trump's superpowers. He's authentically an asshole. You know, he's clear about, hey, I fight everybody. That's what I do. And so it's like, oh, look at that. Some authenticity in a politician.
I do think that that works with his following, that he's the real thing.
Yeah.
Whereas well, the CF is
he's the real thing.
I had a friend who used to claim that about All-Star Wrestling too. Right? Funny.
So what else did you come up with on cancel culture this week? Like, where did your mind wander to on it?
Well, okay. I mean, we kind of went down the public figure problem, which I think is a specialized kind of case. How do you restore your image and survive loss? That's like I say, as long as you're in there pitching, if you go away and do good works as a human being, you can kind of vindicate yourself. Can Cuomo still be riding the same curve that he was? Probably not, right? I don't know of any such strategies that will do that. Or for a certain audience, Louis C.K. he might sort of break even there somehow in the court of public opinion, but he's never going to be the darling child that he was. That's just not, you know, for some people. So I think that's kind of a specialized case. In terms of the overall, you know, issue about cancel culture itself, it just seems to me that why are people so why does it bother so many liberals? Okay, so what is the issue? Like I said, I think we can kind of ignore the right on this issue as just being opportunistic and. This is just another chance to pawn liberals because the right has practiced its own version of this much longer and deeper. So there really is a culture war out there. So and if you look at things like the letter to that was published in Harper's, the open letter on justice by what was the guy's name? Thomas Williams, and signed onto by hundreds of really famous liberals, right?
Gloria My favorite Steiner, was Chomsky was on West. There, right?
What's that?
My favorite was Chomsky was on there.
Noam Chomsky was signing that. And I think I would have been tempted, were I in that position, to sign that statement as well, that somehow this is not, this is illiberalism. This is counterproductive to the mission. So why are otherwise good liberals sort of chilled by this? And what do they, and I think it is because they're supposed to be committed to a different set of principles, right? More democratic dialogue, and this seems to be censorial.
But they're also supposed to be social justice warriors, right? I think those two identities are warring in that moment. That this, and again with the millennials, and I think the youth has that all that energy of social justice warriors. Like, you have to fight these people, and that becomes illiberal because you end up fighting whoever they direct you at. It's, you know, but Those two identities definitely seemed to war in that moment.
Well, it's back to me on, you know, the two extremes on either side practicing some version of this. These are both rhetorics of purification. These both posit an ideal world. Okay, I guess in the Christian's ideal world, we wouldn't have all of this humanist, everybody would, right, have a similar service to God, a similar set of practices, a similar set of ideas and beliefs. And on the extreme left here, if we want to call them that, the social justice warrior left, the woke culture, whatever terms we want to use, there is kind of an ideal operating there that this we would somehow achieve. And the way to achieve this ideal where that we embrace perfectly diversity and right non-discrimination and choice, you know, whatever the world where without those kinds of shamings. Which is a great ideal, and one might want to embrace it. The way we do that is to write police behavior. Okay, so I think those are different. If you're not in that camp, right? Then where are you? And I think that is kind of the uncomfortable position, because one can't then criticize or refine one's comments. There is no, I think, probably the one of the most unsettling aspects is to cut off all debate. I know it's a terrible example, but the current now they've got Pepe Le Pew, right? Pepe Le Pew contributes to rape culture. So we need to somehow dig up this 80-year-old cartoon and censor it. And to even say anything that you don't want to defend Pepe, right?
That'd be a tough attorney assignment. Your client chases this skunk. No, you were the skunk. Chases this cat. Yeah.
Right. But looking at that, I mean, one can't then refine the tools, the critical tools that one looks at. Okay. Is this rape culture? I don't recall any forced aggression in those cartoons. It is a case of mistaken identity. It is a stereotype, right? He's of a French playboy. And so have we really categorized this correctly? What set of ideas are operating there? And I guess that's the reason to tackle such a silly example. But so I don't think we've correctly identified how this influences people. The assumption there is because that takes place in that document, it's going to normalize that and make it seem okay. I don't think actually the text makes it seem okay, right? And so if Donald Trump or Mario Cuomo had seen enough Pepe Le Pew, they would know what unwanted advances look like, right? If people are reacting to you this way, they think you're a skunk. So what is actually being displayed there? So I think that the idea that this ideological purification going on by finding all the instances of this in the world and sort of saying they have this self-perpetuating, I think that is not good criticism. So I think that asks us to choose, you know, to develop better critical tools to ask in the larger picture here, how do these things operate? And that we don't want to cut off things. We don't want to deny history. We don't want to sanitize history. Criticism can certainly look back and say, gee, there were attitudes prevailing there. And maybe in that light, yeah, maybe that's not the most healthy source of humor in the world. But
it does go back to, you know, something we've talked about multiple times already. The transition over into entertainment dominated digital space from, you know, sort of even traditionally like the print oriented linear thinking slowed down critical model, like to deconstruct the text can take a long time. Right. You know, when you deconstruct Pepe Le Pew, like you just did and did some nice little criticism of it and saying, well, is that really in the text or are you assuming? That's not really the game in entertainment. It's speed intellectualism. And that middle ground of, you know, sort of slow, careful criticism, the same way in a court, slow, careful consideration of evidence, it doesn't exist. They're going from here's the accusation and here's the judgment. And it's so fast that is there a space in there for criticism in there anymore?
Well, it goes to judgment, right? And judgment now to repair. We've lived for 80 years with Pepe Le Pew. I'm not sure a lot rides on making sure right at this moment that it's not available. This is part of the critical process. And so it's I don't know about the how slow it is, but subjecting it to dialogue to ask, gee, are there different points of view here to assess this? This and things like it, right? In other words, I'm not sure the game is worth the candle with spending too much time on that example, except that it does seem to be so typical. And it is this sort of flashpoint for people who want to reject the entire conversation, right? Which is one of the bad impacts of it, okay? So we should have been seeking a more dialogic, multi-perspectival form of critique where you can make these kinds of claims and then those claims are themselves subject to critical insight, right?
Yeah, but again, like this is, and I've done this a lot with my kids. So I have an 18-year-old and a 21-year-old and I've watched them. They're both very digital, very, you know, went through all the phases of YouTube to TikTok to, you know, all these different things and very conversant in that. And so they're both super triggerable and super, you know, emotive on the left issues. And when I want to discuss them with them to do exactly what you're talking about, haul it over into my professorial academic world of, you know, slow it down. Let's actually take a look at it. Let's decide, you know, based on what's there, what we want to do with it. So the terminology that Jordan Peterson got so famous on about refusing to use gender pronouns of they and them and things like that at the university. That came up with my daughter because she does a lot in the trans community and a lot with, you know, makeup. And she's been in that community for a long time, very sensitized to it. And she wanted to teach me, you know, what was wrong with the way I was talking. And I'm like, super fine, like teach. But we still have to go back and revisit it and decide whether you are teaching the right things or not. And the only way I know how to do that is kind of what you're talking about. Slow it down, lay it all out, get a bunch of different perspectives, look at the claims and the evidence and reach a conclusion. But that's old school thinking. That processor doesn't really, they don't have that. You have to really slow them down and force them through it. And you can see the pain of it.
Well, but that's, what's the answer then? We just accept this because, you know, you seem to be attributing this to the media environment itself, which may favor that, right? It may be difficult to run against that, but there's still the behavior, which is the desire to judge and police and the idea that this is easy criticism, simply to write parking tickets for these ideological abuses. Does that really do the most good in the long run? Is that really the right, a decent, healthy answer for the public dialogue system?
Not at all, clearly. Right?
And furthermore, what we're observing is this does damage to our systems of cooperation in society. So both sides on the other end playing, you know, they have investments in the war. Can we calm down about those kinds of things? Can we interpose a certain amount of critical reflection and dialogue so that maybe we're censoring or eliminating things that really on the whole are really healthy? Because what we do know is that if you eliminate all this stuff, the behavior doesn't simply go away. The kinds of abuses, say in the church, that where we didn't talk about these things, that didn't seem to work very well.
Yeah, no, I think
where there is no dialogue about it doesn't mean that the behaviors go away. So this idea that we simply eradicate, you know, cleanse the language of these kinds of symbols doesn't mean that the those things disappear.
Well, I think in some ways that's kind of this project for me, for the Rhetoric Warriors and doing the podcast and stuff, because I worked in entertainment so long and I know what that speed feels like. I know what the absolute demand for constant stimulation feels like. And I worked in academics for a long time. And in some ways, you know, I'm a decent intellectual. I'm a horrible academic because I hate being that slow and that detailed. My creative side.
Right. There's a lot of acts of faith there that this critical essay will live some sort of life. And in today's media world, that probably isn't happening as much as people might think.
Yeah, not at all. Like what I find is all these people over here are slow thinking and doing good critical thought. It's not going over into the entertainment world at all. And if you look at Trump, I think is a really good example. What Trump did, I would describe it as ride the avalanche. Like he never slowed anything down. He was just like, this is coming behind me. All these forces, white supremacy, all this stuff is coming behind me. I don't care. I'm going to just constantly feed it. Just throw things in the air, never slow it down. And it just disappears the next day. And I just do three or four more. And what we're talking about is slowing the avalanche down, plucking out, going, well, is this really good in the avalanche? I'm not sure. Like,
well, when you say that constant demand for speed, you know, where is that located? I think in the sort of the cable news talk world, that the demand for content. And I don't know that Trump was such a genius at it, but his
wasn't a genius.
His temperament fed into it pretty well. I guess both the sort of the World Federation and reality show.
And he was a promoter.
But either way, the end result is that living for the 24-hour news cycle and the constancy of it, and not, you know, once again, it's all battle, it's all angst, it's all drama. And so you're right. So certainly the way the media is delivering this is going to inherently favor. I think of the, you know, the John Stewart coming on Crossfire and saying, but wait a minute, you're hurting America, right?
Right.
And in a way, that's kind of what we're saying here, that point counterpoint thing, and the, you know, the standard journalistic thing. Now, I will bring on somebody who thinks this and somebody who thinks this, and we'll be done by commercial break. And I get to be the hero because, right, then I get to say what I think, right? So whatever.
Yes, it's like, but once you get drawn into those aesthetics, and that's the dominant discourse stream, right? Sure. That's why one of the foundational things I have in Rhetoric Warriors is I'm pushing ethical only persuasion. Because if you allow unethical persuaders within this massive digital stream, and that kind of production power and cycle and everything else, I don't know how you slow it down. Like if you allow deception at that level, if you allow conspiracy at that level, and you have them on your TV shows, like the whole Big Lie, they were talking about this a few Sundays ago, every Sunday news show had some insane right-wing politician on pushing the big lie about the election. And they gave them a forum to say that in public. How can people say something that, you know, wrong and treasonous in public with no ramifications whatsoever? Like, to me, that's dangerous. You have a dangerous discourse structure that nobody's policing at all. So I don't care about policing the individual actions. It's more about policing the discourse stream itself.
So then you're really arguing, I think, that cancel culture is itself an adaptation, that this is, that you've got to be absolute, you've got to be singular, and you've got to be repetitive, because of that sort of, if it isn't going to happen now, it isn't going to happen. So that simply this is an adaptation to the dysfunctions of the communication system itself.
In some ways, I think people see, you know, the villainous escape justice all the time. I think it's one of the reasons there's so much fervor in cancel culture. Right. You see Woody Allen, you know, still dodging around, trying to get away from, or almost fairly successfully getting away from the accusations about him. And again, if you take this to a court of law, like I've published before as part of the Logos training I do, like if you ever looked at the rules of evidence for a courtroom, right, how minute and, you know, specific they are, because that stuff scatters and skews so fast unless you have hard and fast rules. None of that operates in the public forum.
Well, there is no due process, right?
There's a lot of undue process.
But I guess the question is, what is the process and how best to interact with it? Seems to me you're, you know, I guess I'm being idealistic here to suggest that were we to try to improve the communication itself, it would be to impose a certain indeterminacy, lack of judgment, a way that we frame these things rather than claim and disclaim.
Total great concept.
So an improved critical vocabulary, improved critical tools would be, you know, and perspective. So can we get people with a greater perspective on this? And indeed, not everybody follows these cable news dramas. I think that's the shocking thing, because we all get in those little bubbles, you know, increasingly toward election time. But the rest of the time, not everybody's living their life that way. There is this kind of second order thing going on. What gets said and reported at the water cooler, what's talked about at the coffee shop, and on. And that's a far less refined kind of system where if we were talking to each other, there might be more give and take, but we're not really talking to each other. And one of the other consequences of what we're talking about is that people are afraid to say anything. I'm frankly a little nervous about having defended Pepe Le Pew, even though that wasn't my intent.
Sure. Right. No, there's, it's a very landmine. Public space is very landminey. And like, professors are not used to this. They classroom, and they have very controlled, you know, documents and tomes that they get to write, and it's edited and everything else. So they're very protected. All of a sudden you throw them into this kind of public discourse space, and they crumble really quickly, because you can't talk your way out of things. You know, you're allowed to make mistakes when you're doing intellectual discussion, right? And eventually you get to a point where everybody's like, that's a good, fairly good position we can all agree on, even though you were mistaken before. And that's okay, you know, but you're taught that in academic circles. That is not okay to be wrong for 90% of the time in normal public discourse.
Right. So in a way you're suggesting, you know, not to keep dwelling on that one instance, but the Cuomo situation, he might do well to try the Ted Cruz strategy, sort of saying, you know, I'm going to take that hit, and the next thing I need to do is to populate this media world with images that contrast.
That's a fine strategy to try. I'm not sure it works as well for the left, but it clearly does work at times for the right.
So not count on any that there will be this sort of profound forgetting, and so apologize if it's kind of a lame story and move on.
Well, Clinton was a good example of that. He was, you know, the first guy who's like, I inhaled, or I smoked, but I didn't inhale. Worst lie ever, but it's a half truth, half lie. And it allowed,
got him some stuff people didn't care about. Yeah,
it just sat there. You know, at the time, they used to care about that one. That was one of the damning things in politics, to have ever touched a drug. You know, that was radioactive back then. But then, you know, Bush comes along and goes, yeah, I did coke. What?
I remember that direct quote, but I think everybody sort of, but there's some agreement, we're just not going to talk about that anymore.
But Clinton had the strategy, the tactic of living, you know, in the liminal space between admitting and denying. Like, I did not have sex with that woman. Well, okay, Mr. Technicality, you know, sure. But he found enough room in that liminal space that he could still live. He could escape most of the punishment, right? And so, like, now that has been constricted, like people don't like that anymore, but it's still a possible one where you put both images in that liminal space, like Ted Cruz did, and you're like, well, let's let them fight it out. I'm just going to back away, but here's a picture of me with bottles, and here's a picture of me going to Cancun. You know, you just, you know, at least they kind of live in the same world in people's minds. I don't know, maybe Pepe Le Pew's like... They make a new cartoon where he's like, I'm so, so sorry.
Well, there may be some work to be done here in terms of how does he restore himself? He was in an untransformed place, and it was a long time ago. So if we were cartoonists, we might take that opportunity.
I agree with you naturally, like the sort of traditional things that have always kept us together as a culture of, you know, reasonable discourse, fair turn taking from each side, you know, good, careful thought. All those things probably are the way we should run our public dialogues and our public discourse. But man, it's slamming up against this new tsunami. And I don't see us really adjusting to that yet, even as the rhetoricians.
Right, right. Well, okay, how can this level of criticism, which in some ways is sort of healthy, right? That we are paying attention to how do images, how does cultural content, right? So there is kind of getting to first base with criticism. But it is that move to condemnation, that move to policing, that wants for perspective, right? That there is, you know, we still do have to preserve our ability to live with each other and cooperate. When you give up on that, and that does seem to be kind of a moment that people are questioning. Are we really just going to divide between blue states and red states? Because ideologically or in the way that we talk about that, we have done so, which is itself tragic because there are so many Republicans living in blue states and there's so many Democrats living in red states. And these places where it's almost a 50-50 vote, right? We're just talking about paralysis there. So clearly a lot of the work of culture can't get done, and politics is part of that, right? Whatever has to happen in terms of political process is impaired by that. And so I think that is, of course, and that was, I think the spirit of the open letter to Justice about cancel culture was, look, as good liberals here, we have to ask, what do we want? We want an open system. We want to open dialogue. We want to open possibilities and different perspectives, and we want to be committed to that.
Are we? Like, I don't think that's true. Like, we have very, limited.
It's an old ideal that's taking some hits.
But we have very limited openings even within that. Nobody is inviting the Nazis to speak at their conference. There's limits on the edges of all that stuff. And now they're just moving the limits further in. I think my problem with that letter was it's still staying back with the old terminologies of this liberalism versus illiberalism. Like you said something a few seconds ago about the word condemnation. So if Cuomo, if you're looking for a micro scripting tactic, if he came out and said, look, just don't condemn me right away. Like he just hit that word. He goes, I get it. I understand, that this is something that's important to people and everything else, but just don't condemn me right away. Let me have some due process here. And I'll tell you what I think I did, and we'll take it to the courts or whatever, but just to reserve condemnation, because like you said, that's become a knee-jerk reaction. There's no space in between the accusation and the condemnation. And what we need to do, I think, as rhetoricians, if we're working this space, is to open that back up and instruct people like, hey, I get it. I get all the feeling and everything that you're trying to do, but we need to hold on to that until we get some actual information. And nobody's getting that training in the digital space because they're just triggered. Trigger, 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 sure. Trigger. And it does create that, hyper emotive state.
And we don't have a very sophisticated, vocabulary to appreciate any subtleties about this. Is this the sense of going ultimate on everything, right? Is this rape culture? Is this sexual predation? And that's the dialogue that we're not having, and really can't have about these sorts of things. So that. Right. So, and in a way that dialogue does happen over time. We just make some lives very, very difficult along the way. But yeah, I mean, what you're saying in a way was the Chuck Schumer press conference this morning when they asked about this. I trust the attorney general completely. This investigation is ongoing. To interject that.
Throw it to the courts. I mean, at least they have due process. They've dealt with these kind of issues for a long time.
Ultimately voters will decide whether this sticks or whether this doesn't stick.
Kinda. I don't trust that, but what I keep coming back to is we haven't carved out the digital space with any type of very focused intellectual management. And I'm not saying you can manage it perfectly because it's run by big corporations and from billions of people flooding into it. But there are ways to instruct people like that. Like I do a lot of non-triggering or de-triggering when I do conversion talk with people, like especially the right. The first thing you have to do is untrigger them and say, look, I don't care what you believe. It's perfectly fine if you think we need to build a wall, or if you like guns, or if you hate immigrants. I don't care. It's not the point. You know, the point is I want to talk to you about how we talk about those things. And so going right at them, hitting all their triggers because you're a social justice warrior, horrible strategy if you want to do any conversion on people. And to me, one of the reasons one of the ways I get some space with like my daughter and millennials and people I do this kind of training with is like, do you want to be effective or do you want to be expressive? Because your culture has taught you to be hyper-triggered and social justice vehement, but that's a bad strategy if you want to go out and get people on your side. And so if you can point that out, like, hey, you're killing your own cause.
So you're a pacifist too. Yes, you're.
Sure.
Right. Yeah, and that's right. These are tiny little border skirmishes in the culture war, and they really feed both sides. Right. We're going to fire a couple of lame rockets over the border here, and we're going to act as though this is the most horrendous attack ever. And we are both cooperating in keeping the conflict alive. And that is from the kind of the traditional rhetorical perspective, that is dysfunctional, right? You can't reach across that. That's what I say, that the ability then to gain platforms of cooperation between these different camps, insofar as you're all going to be, you know, part of the same system, but in a way you are feeding off of each other.
Yeah.
And the principle. Kind of counterpoint crossfire mentality of the media feeds on that.
Yeah. Entertainment principle tells me all I need to do is keep you firing off emotionally. That's it.
Right.
Doesn't matter if it's conflict, doesn't matter if you're on the right or the left. I just have to keep you experiencing new emotions every few seconds. You know, that's the game. And so if you start with that, okay, that's now what rhetoric has become for a lot of people, is like, I'm going to experience some piece of media, you know, some piece of discourse, and I'm going to be emotionally triggered. That's what they're being trained to. So this heightened emotional state, one of the things I also do to de-trigger people is like, how often are you upset? How often are you outraged and frustrated and irritated and angry? That's horrible. Why don't we help you out of that? You know, and I think getting back to that calmer space.
Outrage culture is something shared here by, you know.
Yeah. You get back to the dispassionate, let's just take a look at things, a more intellectualized space. Then you can do some things, but you can't.
Your therapy would be to get people to detach emotions from these mediated experiences. Yeah. Find something else in your life.
Yeah. Who wants to be lab ratted by the media where I'm just pinging your, you know, your amygdala, bang, 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 until it's always on, you know, right. And you can usually offer that as a nice piece of catharsis and rescue for people. And they're like, yeah, you're right. I am on both sides.
So new avenues of both political expression and political participation would seem to be the ultimate remedy. Find different ways of going at this.
Yeah, I think letting people know that public discourse doesn't have to be just what the entertainment media has drug it over into.
Sure.
That the negatives of that, both for the democracy and for individuals. I mean, the amount of anxiety that Trump poured into the world for 5 years, the toll, the emotional toll of that. Oh my God.
And once again, I think that was that was something suffered by the left far more than the right. In other words, there was something expiating about it, cathartic about it for the Trump supporters. This didn't give them anxiety. This somehow was a you know And one has to look at what were they repressing all that time that somehow this is what.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that he allayed anxiety for some people, you know, and I think that goes back to the things like that gets accused of, like a white culture, you know, they now have a champion who's, you know, that sort of white supremacist culture. Like, this guy's not just attacking us. You know, he's not just attacking the stupid. He's not just attacking the things that have traditionally been attacked by, you know, normalized Western democracy. So maybe it was, you know, it's a good point that, you know, you have to look at him too, is like, he did allay some horrible emotion for some people.
Well, he sort of created a space in which their ways of reading the signs and their ways of thinking about the world were given voice. I don't think you can deny that. I think that's what's making the other side nervous, quite honestly. It is this huge burden to the idealist on the other side of the coin. Many people really feel that way. But once again, if you get back to the election results, it's one thing to claim victory. It's another thing to sort of say, wow, 10 million more people voted for this guy in 2020 than voted for him in 2016. What does this tell you? All right.
Yeah. And I, you know, that's one of the things that drug me over into politics, is to look at that and want an answer to that question. You know, what did drag people over there, and what is he doing for them? Because if he did it, he's not a genius. He's just using, you know, a type of rhetoric that's grown up in this type of world that is effective. And I don't like the people that it's, I don't like the block of people that it's creating. So.
I mean, there's a yearning going on there, and it's a bad filling of that need. And of course there is the caution, there could be worse. There could be worse fillings of that need. And that is something to be nervous about, right? But to sort of, once again, the kind of the condescension, or the, that this is either bad morality, stupidity, whatever the ways of dismissing, which are the, you know, the self-addressed. And I think maybe that is ultimately what I would want to say about the culture war, is this is both all self-addressed, each camp unto itself. There really isn't a transcendence that's possible there. And what we know about ethical rhetoric is it needs some prior dialectic. It needs some way of right?
Yeah, you have to have something to point to, that, you know, to compare it to.
Otherwise, there is no resolution. And so there may be on either side this kind of variation of the ultra left versus the middle left, or the ultra right versus the middle right. But that may take the place of, however, for the entire sort of dysfunction by itself, it makes moderation impossible. Because if you're a moderate, then all of a sudden you're the problem.
Yeah.
Or you get nailed as the moderate when you're really not, just because you're not, right? For whatever set of reasons of participating in the extreme. So,
well, it all goes back to kind of what we're launching. To me, like, all this stuff is fascinating. Modern culture, everything gets tangled horribly. And to even just extract one thing, like, okay, let's look at this cancel culture. And then it's like, oh, are we canceling a cartoon? Or are we canceling a real human being or a politician? You have to separate each little piece and look at it. And, you know, to do that, again, slows down. Like, we've been talking for almost an hour and a half. How often do people, you know, on their
really do that
in the middle of the afternoon, get to do that? So,
sure. I mean, yeah, anybody watching this will probably already gone for a drink or something, but
yeah, but that's, I think these resources, again, I try to keep enough entertainment in it so it's got some kind of energy that makes people able to watch it in the modern world. But rhetoric to me is this collection of things that, if we could understand it, extract some of that, it would help us with moving into this new social media digitized discourse, you know. And we're not really harvesting that in a way that I think we should. And again, I think it's dangerous to just let it all marketplace itself out in that type of environment. It's just You get Russia, you get all these people you don't want in your marketplace. Like Russia is in our democratic marketplace and they're doing really, you're doing really well. Like they're having a flash sale and everybody's buying. And that's a problem.
And they're not invested in these issues or these outcomes. So
no, they're just, it's just destruction, which is a very easy rhetorical agenda to achieve, much harder than construction, you know, absolutely, and management, absolutely, protection.
Well, and I do think that's kind of a bottom line, and maybe we just need to package all of this better. But these are rhetorics of purification, and to step back at some point and say, why are these ways of being right now? And it's maybe because of the kind of the confusion of the middle, and that's where you're finding Mr. Putin working, right? And it's been said many times along the way. It doesn't matter which side wins as long as the confusion, right, the ethical confusion exists. That serves their purposes.
Yeah, it's that, you know, destructive uses of rhetoric or rhetorical tools. And it's one of those things that if we don't marshal our good resources that we've developed for the last 2,500 years and think about some of this stuff.
Right, because the digital space may bring a lot of new things with it, but these are not new things.
Right.
Right. These are not new things. And once again, democracy's always been kind of, you know, an experiment. It's always been, and it seems to me asking, is this side or that side the enemy of democracy? But the sideism is itself.
Yeah.
No doubt.
The binary of the only thing, you know, that makes it possible for us to have discussions, you know, binarying things as opposed to multivarying things. You can't have a multivariate discussion. Like human beings just can't do it. You know, you can do multivariate analysis and then bring things out and kind of talk about it. But this multi-environment, again, which is supernatural in digital space, super enabled by the technology, is just a brain, you know, dynamite to human beings. Like they can't do it. And that's also what you're saying is, I think when you get back to simple stories and simple rhetoric, one of the reasons it becomes so dominant and so attractive to people is that it's just, my God, over here, this tangle is so much, my brain can't work. But over here, hey, you know who's a problem? The right, people want right, to get rid right. of Pepe Le Pew. Remember Pepe? He was a great skunk. All right, well, this was fun again.
Good to see you.
What you want to make, or I like the purification thing. I think that's a great word to pull out of this, and it explains a lot of it.
Well, and we've never, you know, and I don't think we would really want to achieve it if we could. I think that's the right. That's only the prelude to another serious division. So,
You can purify one thing in the democratic body, a toe maybe, but then the rest of it's like, the rest of it's just horrible.
Right.
You don't get to purify entire systems very often.
Well, thanks for checking in. I enjoyed it.
Yeah, absolutely. This was fun. Again, Rhetoric Wednesdays, we're going to deep dive into rhetoric and whatever issue that we pull up. And thanks again, Dr. David Payne.
Glad to be here. Thanks.